Nebenstimmen. Der Podcast von und mit Mitgliedern des Ensemble Modern. In Nebenstimmen hören Sie Gespräche von Ensemblemitgliedern mit von Ihnen selbst ausgewählten Gesprächspartnerinnen und Partnern zu Musik, Kunst und Leben. Erfahren Sie, woran die Musikerinnen und Musiker gerade arbeiten und was sie persönlich beschäftigt.
Welcome to Nebenstimmen. I'm Paul Cannon, double bass player of the Ensemble Modern. Today I'm joined by André Ademek, composer, conductor, performing artist. André, my very first question for you, how do you pronounce your first name?
André.
On, so English on?
Yes.
On?
Then d.
D.
And then a tricky sound.
So there's like a z and a r.
Yeah.
Zrrr.
Yeah. Like very fast tremolo on contrabass with little sul ponticello in it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to call you André, if that's okay.
It's fine.
So, André, we're working on a project at the moment.
Right.
It's called Connection Impossible. Mm. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later in this episode. But I want to take you back about 10 years to the first time you and I met. Which would have been a recording session up in Hamburg on a piece called Karakuri.
Right.
That piece involves quite a lot of special activities, let's say. So not only playing instruments, we also have a singer. She's moving around. She's speaking. She's singing. One might say she's acting. Mm-hmm. And the musicians as well are doing quite a bit more than just playing their instruments. We're making all kinds of sounds and noises, and I don't recall in that piece if we do a lot of vocalizing. I'm curious in general about your interest in more performative music, and not these kinds of, how would one say that? It's not only music in terms of sound, it's also about gesture and so forth.
Right. Yes. So there are several influences. When I was very young, like 15 years old till maybe 20 in Prague, I did some performative concerts, like as a multi-instrumentist, and we moved mostly in the room. It was like playing by moving. And then I quite quit it when I studied in Paris. I was very much focused on orchestration and instrumental ensemble writing. And when I moved to Berlin in 2010, then I started again to develop this will or this wish or dream that a performer on the stage is not just instrumental player or singer, is somebody who has a stage presence, a body presence, and who can accompany with a gesture also his sound. And I started to notate some little tiny theatrical actions, probably first in this piece Karakuri, or maybe a piece Imademo. It was kind of preparation for Karakuri, written for Shigeko Hata. Me sample playing and my wife playing viola. Mm-hmm. And then I did Karakuri, where Shigeko Hata mostly use language, speaking, talking, but also singing, screaming, and very often accompanied by her own gestures. But also you as ensemble, you have to connect to her sometimes without score and do also some visual gesture. And I was more and more developing this dream. And this piece we do now, Connection Impossible, is kind of like climaxing in,
right.
in this dream where you as musicians of Ensemble Modern, you are also singers. You have to speak, move and play sometimes different instruments.
I would call it ambitious. You've given us quite a lot to do and we're all climbing a mountain together. And I do want to talk about that in a little bit, mm-hmm. More specifically. But I want to break down a few elements of your work, which as a sum total, I find very unique. Mm-hmm. That you have these performative actions, which have a little bit to do with dance, I suppose, but dance in a way that an instrumentalist might understand. So it is notated in the score. You also have clearly a very strong interest in language. Mm-hmm. So in this piece now, I don't know how many different languages you have us speaking, but it's more than any of us speak. So first of all, I'm curious, how many of those languages do you yourself speak?
So I like languages. I'm quite good in, or used to be quite good in learning languages, especially speaking and understanding, much more than writing and reading. So I speak very well Czech, and my French is good. And then German and Spanish and English are quite all right. I'm very interested in improving the sound of it, the pronunciation. That I mostly work with language coaches when I write vocal music. And then, yeah, I learned some Italian. So I have some ideas about six languages. In this piece, we have more languages because each of you pronounce at least one sentence in your native language. So we have about 12 languages.
Right.
But it's also, I would not say I write choreographies. I would not say it's ambitious. I just use the potential you already have. And this idea that you can be without instrument like a dancer, it comes really... I just don't remember if you were first or Isabel Faust was first, but it was just writing a piece of music and putting the instrument and bow aside. And you, string players, you just produce a beautiful and super precise choreography that nobody else can produce. No dancer would be able to do.
So you're talking about this passage where we imitate playing a string instrument.
When you play my score without key, without holding instrument and without holding bow.
Right.
You don't imitate anything. You really do.
Right.
We just don't hear it.
Well, I find the language work that you do, and not only in this piece, but going all the way back to Karakuri, or more recently, we premiered a piece called Let Me Tell You a Story. Mm-hmm. I've also recorded together with Eva Boca, we recorded your chamber Noise, mm-hmm. which also had quite a lot of performative actions. That's a duo for double bass and cello. You had us speaking French and Japanese in the score at some point, chanting a kind of Buddhist mm-hmm. text. And I'm curious how much of that is about the substance of the text that we're saying, and how much of that is more of an interest in the phonetics, the sound of the language itself.
So there is always both, you know. I'm very interested in phonetics and also interested in the meaning. And I try sometimes to look literally inside a world and see how much the meaning of the world is already expressed in the sounds inside.
Hmm.
But for example, the pieces you mentioned... Also, it happens often to me as my ear is somehow open to the languages and I travel and I live a while in each country and want to understand the people and the language. And then something happens. Also in Japan, I lived 5 months and was learning Japanese and then heard this important Heart Sutra. And I wanted to see what it is about, what is the language. It's actually Japanese pronunciation of Chinese text. But the first word is completely deformed Sanskrit word. And the meaning is super beautiful. And that's why I put it in the piece that was very much, the chamber noise, very much about all possible Japanese voices or voices inside Japan. So I don't... want to be too anecdotic or superficial, but sometimes I put my life experience of some voice or text or language in a piece.
That piece is an interesting example of some of the things you write. The meaning of the text and what's used actually is quite serious and quite profound. Because of the way things are written, there's a lot of extended techniques and a lot of very special gestures, let's say, that might on first hearing come across as funny or an attempt of humor. And I'm curious how much of that is intentional and how much of that is perhaps a misinterpretation.
I don't really know. Sometimes people ask me about humor in my music, or I don't really search for humor. I don't let the people laugh. But for example, if I take a language, a sentence, and I decide an instrument will speak this sentence out, and then it's like if a papagai is learning... Do you say papagai in parrot?
A parrot, yes.
A parrot is learning to speak, or a little child is learning to speak. There's maybe something funny about it. But my intention is not to make something funny, you know? And my intention is not to make something super serious, but my intention is to communicate with my musicians and with public through the musicians and, to let the public to erleben, to live something special, maybe also emotionally, to move the public.
Right, right. Well, that's a piece I particularly enjoy performing, and we've performed that quite a few times, the chamber noise. Mm. And that's a piece I find works, of course, best in person. I mean, we made a recording, but you miss all of these gestures and even facial expressions. Mm. You notated in the score how we should hold our face at certain points. I think all of that kind of sets up my next question. Because so far we were talking about concert pieces. So pieces which are meant to be performed by musicians in a concert hall or a concert space.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And now we're moving into what I suppose we would call music theater.
Mm-hmm.
I know you also recently wrote an opera.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if, on your terms, how would you identify the difference, if there is one, between those three forms?
Yes. It's a tricky thing. It depends also on language. But for me, I like to, for example, about my last piece in Köln, I call it an opera.
Right.
Ines is for me an opera. What we do here is a music theater. And if you say in French, théâtre musical, it has a special meaning that I like very much. It's the piece where the composer tries to write in the score an action that is a stage action. And the biggest composers who started that would be, of course, Georges Apergis, Heiner Goebbels, Karlheinz Stockhausen.
Right,
but those who continue very successfully would be many others, like Brigitta Muttendorf or the Simon Sten Andersen. Many. Not that many.
Yeah.
But I like this our effort to try to notate an action that is a visual action. And there is always something a little bit naive because a composer conceives everything on a table. But the stage action, you cannot really decide that well in advance.
Yeah, I think that's been part of the special learning curve we're having with this piece in particular. What do I mean by that? That there's quite a lot notated in the score, but there's still room for development, let's say, because we don't know in the end what's actually going to work in a practical sense,
exactly. Or
what made sense on paper might not make sense in the space.
Right.
So we're still working that out. And I suppose that's part of what I meant by ambitious.
Yeah.
That's quite a risk.
So this is my first score where I try to be again simple as I used to be between 15 and 20 years old.
Okay.
And to give you a room to put something on top of it or to develop it, not to be over-specifying like I'm normally always, I have always been.
Right. I should mention for our listeners, since I suppose most people listening haven't seen your scores, they are full of detail.
Yeah.
Every single note has some information on very precisely, and you are a very precise person. I think that's one of the defining characteristics of your musical aesthetic, if I may. That
I'm precise in some regards. So I would say my ideas come normally through my voice and language.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to notate them in the way I always think maybe it's the wrong way of composing, but I think, how can an interpret misinterpret my idea?
Right.
What should be on the paper that he has no choice to do it completely wrong?
Right.
But in this piece, Connection Impossible is still different because a lot of you have beautiful voices, like you especially, Paul. You have incredible range, but it's still very close to my personal intimate voice. It's different to the opera singers. It's different to Tara or to pop singers. It's something very natural, very human, very simple, but in your case, with a huge possibilities. And I try to find those voices out in this piece and to let them sound, if possible.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, that is always the thing. When you put musicians on stage and ask them to do things which are not the things we've trained for, principally reading a score and playing our instrument. So if you have me singing, I've never taken a voice lesson in my life.
Please don't take any.
I kind of don't want to. Because
you know your voice, maybe we can cut it out if you want. But you do incredible things in the moment when you start. I don't know if you make fun or if you are provoking or if you are experimenting, but when you start like to overdrive your voice, there are incredible things coming out.
Well, that's one of the things I enjoy in this ensemble. First of all, as you noticed, we keep things light.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's part of it. But there's also the space for experimentation. Yeah. So in these early phases of rehearsals, when, you know, right now we have the luxury of quite a lot of rehearsals.
Yes.
And we have the space to try things out. Yeah. So when I have an indication to use my voice, and it's not specifying precisely what voice type or whatever, I will try a few things out. And some of them, maybe it's a provocation, but I think you've already noticed sometimes those provocations end up working.
Yes, the question is how we can conserve something that I liked that happened for some reason, that happened because by mistake or by accident or by provocation, how to keep it. So it's also what I try when I write for you this music theater piece, to use a musician in the way that I notate something that only a highest level musician like you are can do and easily do. For example, I can notate super, I can specify super in very detail the rhythm or the pitches.
Yep.
And that you can reproduce, but how to specify the color of the voice. So, for example, when you have, you've implied, you were exaggerating like two times, but I find it just great. But Thomas says, in your face, there's an action afterwards that he needs to work on it, you know? But I want this voice. I want this voice in the show. That's why I write super high pitches, just to force you to go to this high exaggerated voice.
No, I know what you're talking about. I don't know.
How would you call this voice? Like overdriven or distorted or exaggerated? Or
now you're asking how to notate that. I have no idea how to notate that. And you know, as I said, I'm not a singer. I'm not a voice artist, and I'm not an actor. So it's always a bit confusing for us if we start getting acting advice or vocal advice as if we would know what that meant.
Yeah. But that's the thing that we want to do in music theater. We don't want you to be an actor or a dancer or a singer. We want to provoke in a smart way, something written in the score, some amazing performance, amazing experience that only you can do because the pitch is written so high or the dynamics is written so loud or the combination or maybe the stress of your fast pizzicato accompanying this dialogue, you know?
Right. I mean, I couldn't possibly tell you what I'm thinking when I play that because you've overloaded the part, I think intentionally. So you have me playing this quite complicated glissando pizzicato thing very fast and at the same time matching with a text.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you keep asking for more and more. So at this point, I'm just screaming the text out. I'm not sure if there's a better way to notate that, to be totally honest.
Okay. Yeah. But it's also something super interesting, like to overload you in the score in a way that the stress causes something incredible, you know, that you cannot easily do with other people, with dancers, singers, or actors.
Let's talk specifically about the project, since we're already on the topic anyway. The piece is called Connection Impossible.
Right.
And as of this recording, we've just wrapped up the third day of rehearsals.
Yes.
Now, we still have, I think, 2 weeks until the premiere. This will premiere in Bregenz on July 27th, 2024.
Yes.
Let's talk about the title first. What is Connection Impossible? What is that referring to?
So first came some ideas and sketches, and we did some tryouts already 2.5 years ago, and then 1.5 year ago, and then 2 months ago. And the feeling was it would be about a communication, but communication that is somehow impossible. There are obstacles. For example, I speak, but nobody answers, nobody listens. Or I speak to an ancestor soul, but I don't hear the answer. He speaks to me back, but I can't really catch it. This unreachable, uncatchable. Or also this situation that I use in the part 6, that maybe we speak more specifically about women that speak with their men, but the men are far and they cannot really see them. They cannot even be sure that her husband really answering. And this is to those women standing on the street in front of a prison.
So, but this is a real place, this
right.
What it's referring to. This
yes.
This isn't just a figment of someone's imagination. This is a real situation.
Right.
I think you said in Hamburg?
Yes.
So there's a prison
yes.
in the middle of the city.
Yes.
And women will stand outside and try to communicate
yes.
with the prisoners inside.
Right.
Presumably their husbands, boyfriends.
Probably,
family,
yes.
perhaps.
Yeah. I think this prison is only for men, if I'm right.
Okay.
And there is a huge street. So first what I saw was just women standing and shouting intimate questions or answers. And then later I just realized there are some voices answering, but far we have a huge street in between when there is a lot of traffic. And then we have this sentence that just it says it's completely illegal, this communication in between.
Right.
So it became a kind of model of my ideas for this project.
That's fascinating. Have you been there in person?
Yes.
Okay.
It really started by me going from my hotel to the rehearsal with Ensemble Resonance and just seeing these women screaming and not understanding what's going on and just starting to stop and observe and hear something more.
Wow.
Yeah.
A minute ago, we were talking about a different scene. I have a text to speak while I'm playing, and that scene is called Debate.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell our listeners what that debate is about?
So it's Thomas Fiedler who found out this debate. And the debate is between an Indian guru, quite famous one, that I already knew before and sometimes mm-hmm. listened to. And he has a beautiful power of speech, yeah, a beautiful oratory capacities. And he meets the law students, and those law students are comparing to him quite shy and don't have maybe this power of speech or this oratory possibilities. And they try to show him he is wrong. And the debate was about if in India the people should be obliged to stand up when the national anthem is played.
If they should be obliged to stand up.
Really, yeah.
Okay.
And just to know that probably in Indian, they play it in each cinema, so they play it often. And the people probably don't want to stand up. This guru thinks those symbols in India are very important because the country is huge. The country actually does not really exist. It exists only in the minds of people. It's a concept. And till the people just start to be really together, they need those national symbols. That's his speech. And the law students try to show him that he is wrong. Like, look at the Germany, what happened with the nationalism. And he says, don't compare them with us because they were against the people inside their country. And they worked a lot on it afterwards. And they are so far that they don't need any more national symbols, but we still need them because we are on the very beginning. So the debate is already interesting, but what is super interesting is the rhythm of the debate, because he actually cuts the young guy in a way that is not arrogant, but is very powerful. And the guy is just trying to say something, but at the end, yeah.
So
his ideas are so small in... comparison to this guru. It's my feeling. Yeah.
So the impossible connection there is the student. I guess I'm the student in this case. Is trying to make a point and trying to have a conversation and is just getting cut off repeatedly.
Yes.
Right. But the point of the guru, the teacher, is that they need this these national symbols for a national connection.
Right.
So you're addressing this connection issue on several points.
Right.
There.
Okay. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to go through every single scene of the project. They're all quite different from each other, but they all have that. Mm-hmm. Well, they have connection as a connecting line.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, just in general, about your sources of inspiration. Uh-huh. Do they tend to be so concrete like that? Or do you also take inspiration from more abstract things?
They can be very concrete.
Yeah.
So there's some vocal experience can be really a source for a whole piece. But this piece was very much structured by Thomas Fiedler. I brought him some sketches, so a lot of ideas are from me, but then he really decided how the whole piece would be structured, and he brought some new texts, like this one. It was completely his initiative. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful help, because usually I'm quite alone when I compose, but when I'm with somebody like Katharina Schmidt or Thomas Fiedler or Eric Oberdorf, it's much easier to work. It can beautifully develop in a new way that I really appreciate.
I mean, I'm still just getting introduced to the piece, but I already appreciate that there's quite a lot of concrete references, but not necessarily references which the audience is meant to know or meant to understand. It's just a starting point for the work that you've done.
Correct.
So I don't know. I find that to be an interesting process, that it's starting from a very concrete point and then becoming more abstract, rather than, I suppose, starting from an abstract point and remaining abstract.
Sometimes it was also very abstract, like this, why did I tell? First was an idea that each syllable will have its own pitch, you know, and its own length, and it was very much constructed. It seems to be a kind of dialogue between Tara's exhaling voice and Tara's inhaling voice, but at the end it's really a structure, a musical structure, developing very short motifs to longer, creating kind of feeling of somebody who maybe asks somebody who doesn't live anymore if he did something wrong and if the other one knew about it. Could be the feeling, but not necessarily.
Great. Connection Impossible will premiere at the Bregenzer Festspiele on July 27th, 2024. André Ademek, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Das war Nebenstimmen, der Podcast von und mit Mitgliedern des Ensemble Modern.